this is the Hermetic Hour. It's Thursday, August 29th, 2013. I'm your host, Pope Runyon, and tonight we present a discussion on the 28th path of the Tree of Life, which leads up from Yesod, that's the realm of the collective unconscious of the microcosm, up to Netzach, the realm of the natural forces of the macrocosm. And in the Hermetic tradition, this path is attributed to Aquarius and the tarot trump, the star. Now, however, Aleister Crowley was moved to interchange the star with the emperor. Now, we will discuss his reasons for this and its implications. And this is an important symbolic path for neo-pagans and for those who venerate the goddess. So, tune in and we will try to walk this path both ways. And before we get started here, I want to apologize to Mark last week. He called in early before the show started. And I brought him on and I said, just hang on a minute, let me get the show set up and describe what we're going to do and whatever, get started, and then we'll get back to you. Well, unfortunately, we got involved in it. This was the show on our Shasta trip, at which we just come back from, and so all of us that went up on the Shasta trip, we all called in, and we were all wound up on the Shasta trip. And we, unfortunately, forgot poor Mark was hanging on there. Now, some of you folks call in early, and you just listen to the show on the phone. Well, that's fine. We don't mind that. That's okay. Go and do that. But if you want to talk to us now, one thing I'd like to ask you is, please try to keep your questions on the topic that we are discussing on this particular evening. And that's easy to do because all you have to do is just go to the website and you'll see the topic up there and it's described in the abstract. You'll know just what we're talking about. And if there's something in along the line of that topic and you want to add or you want a question or something like that, we welcome you to call in. We want you to. But we do want to keep it on topic because, as you know, one of the things that's good about the Hermetic Hour as opposed to other shows like this is that we do have a kind of an instructional sort of thing. We deal with a progressive instructional format here, and so we actually learn a lot about Hermetic philosophy and practical Hermetic science by keeping up with this. So that's why we like to keep the questions on topic. Okay. Now, with that said, is there anybody that's out there that has a question on topic? Okay, if you don't have any questions, then we'll just proceed. Okay, now, tonight we're continuing with our exploration of the Tree of Life, going on up the paths. This particular path tonight is very important and it's controversial. And it goes, as we said, it's the 28th path, and it goes from Yesod, which is the lunar sphere, you know, right there in where the astral plane starts, and it's that wonderful violet sphere. It's this very mysterious, the sphere of memory, the sphere of the foundation, the beginning of the astral plane. It's the gateway to the higher realms. But as I said in the abstract, it can be considered the realm of the collective unconscious of the microcosm. I'll unravel that for you. The collective unconscious is a concept that we get from Carl Jung, who is one of the people responsible for rehabilitating Hermetic science, because Carl Jung's philosophy is very, very Hermetic, and his psychology and his philosophy. And so what Carl Jung conceived of was a transpersonal dimension which he called the collective unconscious. And in this collective unconscious are a number of, quite a large number of what he called archetypes. And these archetypes are universal. They're not particularly tied to any one race or culture. They're sort of universal archetypes, which they may take on the coloring and the nomenclature of a particular culture, but they're universal archetypes like the trickster and the shadow and the bogey, and we all have them in every mythology and every race, but they're transpersonal in the sense that we all have them, and according to the way Carl Jung theorized this, you could kind of sink down deep and deep and deep and deep and deep into your subconscious till you got to this level, and then you would be actually in contact, in a very real sense, you'd be in contact with every other deep subconscious mind. This is kind of a sleeping, it's like the universal mind, but the universal mind in this sense is always asleep. A way to describe this would be that the great world soul, which is made up of all of us, but it's asleep and it's dreaming. And this is the realm of the dreams of the world soul. And this is a very powerful realm, but it's also a realm that is not easy to get really deep down into it. And to once you get there, to be able to really analyze it or control it or whatever. So it's a realm of mystery, and this is one of the aspects of Yasod, which is very lunar. And of course, Yasod is attributed to the moon, and that's apropos because it's the lunar cycle. It has quite an influence on our psyche and what have you. So this is Sphere 9, the Yasod, which we go directly up to, on the 32nd path. Now, so technically, from our point of view, the 28th path over to Netzach and the 30th path on the other side over to Hod are actually what we would call paths that would be reached by the boat, because there's no point in walking all the way up the 32nd path and then going through Yasod and then walking, and then what you've already done, and then walking the other path. So we had developed Kusor's boat, which we have discussed before, and which those of you are in the associate member program, you can see Kusor's boat in our pathworking video. But this gives you a way to get over, fly over the paths you've already done. And so this, like the 30th path, the collective intelligence that we did before, this 28th path is a boat working, okay? Well, but you will walk the path. In other words, you'll use the boat to get up to your side, and then you will walk the 28th on over to Netzach. Now, that's just the technical aspect of it as far as the hypnotic reverie is concerned. As you know, what we do is we go into a trance, and it's a guided trance. The magus will get everybody relaxed and get hypnotized using a tattva symbol, either on the soul door or an overhead mirror, and we will go through into the astral state, close our eyes, and we'll be in a trance. And then our tour guide will take us along on this symbolic journey, and we will acquire these attention points, and along the way we'll see symbolic features and entities and whatever, and they will teach us, each of us individually, for ourselves, we will learn what these particular attention points have to teach us. And that's why pathworking is actually it's a form of initiation. It's not just an entertainment. And well, let's face it. I mean, if it was just an entertainment, why would we bother with it? Because we could go to Disneyland or something and get, you know, and get more of a balance. But this is actually an initiation, because these attention points give you special information about this particular esoteric aspect of the path that applies to you, and you remember it. Now, in this case, or this particular path leads from Yesod, as I described. That's the great realm of memory, the sphere of memory, the great sphere, the dark mirror, the sphere of the moon, the beginning of the astral plane, the sphere of the emotions, and whatever. And we're going to go from there to number seven, and that's Netzach, and that is the sphere of nature, the natural forces, the natural, the elementals of nature, the great goddess. The great goddess actually is the best symbol for this path. Now, in our particular tradition, that's Astarte, and we have her in giant form sitting in a beautiful temple in an asana position, and she's translucent, and you can see all of her psychic centers glowing inside her, and she herself becomes an initiator in this sense. And that's our way of conceiving the central motif of Netzach. But Astarte is cognate with Green Tara. You might even say Kuan Lin. You could say any great goddess who is nurturing and fulfilling and nurturing and is an expression of nature would be your supreme archetype and your symbol for this sphere. And also, this is the sphere that you would say is the realm of the elements of nature and in harmony with the positive spirit of nature. Now, so there's a lot to be learned, but there's also, in this sphere, there's also unrestrained and potentially unbalanced force, great attraction. Now, we've been following in our pathworking discussions, we've been using Gareth Knight's Practical Guide to Kabbalistic Symbolism, which is a two-volume set. It came out back in 1972, is this particular printing. And he analyzes all these paths and for the most part, does a very good job. Now, this particular path, however, Gareth Knight, Basil Wilby, did something that is rather surprising given his position in the fraternity of Inner Light, which is Dion Fortune's old group. I don't quite understand, he hasn't quite explained to me why he opted in this particular path to go for Crowley's switch on the tarot card to apply to this path. Let me get into that a little bit. For those of you who might not have been following all our pathworking programs. Hermetic Kabbalah. Now, I'm not talking about rabbinical Kabbalah. I'm talking about Hermetic Kabbalah. The tarot cards are very, very important. And they're attributed to the paths. And they're very important. And they're not all that old as far as the attributes are concerned. Eliphas Levy, the French magus back in the 1860s, he is the first magician in, well, as far as we know, he's the first magician to equate the tarot cards with the Hebrew alphabet. And so he did that, And he was almost, he almost got it right. He came very, very close. He put the fool at the bottom, which is fairly logical. And then he had a kind of a bad selection for justice and strength. He didn't get those quite right, but otherwise he got it. And but then we didn't actually put the tarot cards on the paths until the cipher manuscript of the Golden Dawn, which remained secret for quite a while. And then finally, when it did break loose, and then Arthur Leighton got a hold of it, and he did a very nice version of it with a lady artist by the name of Pixie Smith, and they did it. And then it became just worldwide. It exploded. The attributes of the tarot cards to the paths are so absolutely amazing in their synchronicity that even though this came very, very late, just in the last few hundred years, that the synchronicities are so amazing that they just have to be there. It's just something that we know. It's a marriage made in heaven. It really is. And so we won't argue about this or Hermetic Kabbalah, and the tarot cards are very important to this, to our symbolism. By the way, Ralph Metzner has what is considered by the authoritative book on the occult tarot. And I'll mention this right now. History of the Occult Tarot, 1870-1970, by Ronald Decker and Michael Dummett. And Dummett spelled D-U-M-M-E-T-T, for those of you guys who want to get on Amazon and one-click it. This is the authoritative masterwork on the history of the Occult Tarot. And it's so extensive that I'm even mentioned in it. And along with our cipher book. Now, Ralph Metzner has, according to these folks, he has the best book on the psychological blending of the new psychological blending of the tarot, the significance of the tarot. And we're going to get into that on a future show. But let me say this about this attribute on this particular path. Now, according to the Golden Dawn, and according to the Cipher Manuscript, according to Leighton, all the rest of the people that did the tarot and whatever, matched it up to the Hebrew alphabet, that was Levy and the whole business. The trump, the star, which is very definitely Aquarian, and if you recall the star, how it looks. It's this beautiful, appropriately nude woman kneeling down at a stream and filling in a water jug, and very, very Aquarian symbolism with the seven-pointed star of Venus over her head. And as I said, the path itself is attributed with the letter Zadi, the fish hook, the letter Zadi. The path is attributed to the sign of Aquarius. The card is obviously the sign of Aquarius. That's just what it is, the symbolism. Now, let's go a little further. This path is right on the lightning flash coming down from Kether. And that lightning flash is very important, especially if you do chakras. And on that lightning, so consequently, that lightning flash coming through seven, that's down to nine, has to have the proper symbolism, and it has to fit. And that proper symbolism is perfect, based upon what Netzach is, the sphere of nature, the goddess, and everything else, and then it's coming down into the subconscious, the collective unconscious here. And so what have we got here with this star tarot card? We have Aquarius communication, innovation. It's positive. It's beautiful. It's It's the age of Aquarius.
Well, but, you know, it really is the right, it's the right card. It's the right one, especially if you come down the lightning flash. Now, what, why, and I don't know, well, why would Crowley want to take and put the Emperor down there and then take the star and put it way up there at 15? Now, why would he want to do that?
Well, he wanted to do that because I was told him to. Now, those of you, I'm sure, you know about the Book of the Law and Crowley and his wife Rose. They went on their honeymoon in Cairo in 1904, and they got up in this, and I don't know whether it was Shepherd's Hotel or where, but whatever, it was somewhere up in Cairo, and they smoked some funny stuff, and they really got, yeah, they were having a lot of fun. And they'd been to the museum that day, and they'd seen this particular stella, and then Rose started channeling, and Crowley started writing, and she started channeling, he started writing, and they went furiously at it for, I don't know how long, a day and a half or something like that, and they came up with a very remarkable book, Liberalia Legis. This is what the Thelemic sodality is based on, and this is a very, very, very profound, very definitely a spiritual work. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But the Book of the Law is also disturbing. In fact, it even disturbed Crowley, as outrageous as he was. He was disturbed by it because it was a savage new statement. It was based upon ancient Egyptian philosophy, but it was the testament of Horus, the crown conquering child, coming after Osiris and abrogating karma and supplanting the entire Osirian system. Now, that takes some explaining. The Osirian system, of course, was the system of the Golden Dawn. It was Rosicrucian. It matches up, the whole Osiris legend matches up with the Christian mythos. And in fact, you can say really that Christianity is a sort of a rerun of the Osirian tragedy, the Osirian passion. And with all of its idea of living a good life and loving your neighbor and everything, and if you do all that, well, you'll be rewarded in the afterlife. That's Osirian philosophy, and that's also Christian. Not so with the New Testament of Horus, I see, according to the Book of the Law. Well, anyway, this was delivered by a supernatural entity who called himself Iwas, it sounds like I'm criticizing it, but I'm really not. It is what it is. And it is obviously a delivered work, and it's obviously profound, but it does have that aspect. Now, the curious part about this is, Iwas, at a certain point in the book, I forget which chapter, he says to Rose, and Crowley writes it down, that all of the old letters of my book are correct, except Zadi, which is not the star. Now, that's all he said. He didn't say the emperor. He just said Zadi, which is not the star. Now, boy. So Crowley, he puts the book away puts it away in a trunk and leaves it alone for about 7 years, and when he looked at it, then he gets it out, and then he finally realizes, oh, this is it. This is what I got to do. You know, I got to follow this. So he's working on his own tarot system, which is very, very good in many, many ways, and we'll discuss that too. But he has to do something about Zadi there in that in this path. He feels like he has to do something. So why does he take the emperor? Well, one reason, and it doesn't really go along very much with Iwas's philosophy, but it does go along with Victorian philosophy, curiously enough, is the suppression. Put the emperor in there in that path
And you're blocking all of those natural forces. The emperor stands there as a conscious, logical, a law-giving being, the great lawgiver, the great controller, the emperor, very masculine, very patriarchal. And he's there as a plug in that path, right on the lightning flash, where the lightning flash comes down and comes through nature with all those natural forces and sex magic and everything else, and the goddess and orgies, if you want to look at it that way, and whatever, coming right on down into your subconscious. So the Victorians, especially the Christian Victorians, they would say, well, let's put the emperor there. He'll stop him. But he'll do it. But Crowley was rebelling against that. So why would he do this? He didn't have to. I mean, I gave him a number of choices. I'm not going to get into a whole bunch of paraphernalia, but yeah, he did have better choices if he wanted to do a switch. But for some reason, whether he did that. Now, one reason he said he did was because he put the zodiac on a Mobius strip, which looks kind of like a lazy figure eight. And then he got, by doing that, he ran the zodiac around that. And then he found out that he had he could, by twisting the zodiac into these two, like a pretzel, he could justify exchanging these two. I think that's just clever. I mean, I do things like that. I've done lots of stuff like that, but that's just clever. That you're using cleverness to justify changing really, really significant symbolism. I mean, cleverness is not enough. You've got to have more than cleverness before you start doing something like that. So I can't. I'm still wondering why in the dickens he did this. So let's say this. The emperor belongs up there on path 15, and the star belongs on our 28th path. And if anybody want to call in and argue with me on that, you're more than welcome to. But that's the way the Golden Dawn has it, and that's the way we do it, and that's the way BOTA does it, and that's the way, most of us do it that way. Now, I think those of you who have that Thoth deck, I don't see any reason why you can't just make the switch yourself. I mean, and the Thoth deck is beautiful. I mean, it's really, and the Thoth deck, like no other Golden Dawn type deck, is properly colored, except Crowley and Predyarus' Thoth deck. It's the only one that uses the proper color formula for those paths. And that's why, one of the reasons why it resonates with you so much magically. You go through those Thoth cards and you said, oh boy, these are magical. Whereas people who just put down any colors that you feel like on these, it jars you. The color has to be keyed very carefully from the minutum mundum. Now, what's the minutum mundum? Well, the minutum mundum is a combination of paths in the king scale and spheres of queen scale. And there's a reason for that, but we won't get into that right now. I think we discussed that in our earlier shows. Now, let's talk, though, about a little bit about the symbolism of the lightning flash and going down and coming back up. Because if you take the lightning flash, as we are wont to do, and straighten it out, it's also called the flaming sword, by the way, and you take that sword and you grasp it up north of Kether by its hilt, and you straighten it out, then you have all of these spheres in a straight line. And then you have a psychic center system. You have what is the Western psychic center system. And I know some of the people out there are saying, oh, no, that's not the Western. It's da, 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 da. Yes, it is. It is. Overwhelmingly, it is. And one of the reasons why that has not been so clear is because the theosophists got into the game and they did their own kind of bollock stuff version of Woodruff's version of the Hindu arrangement. And that Unfortunately, Paul Chase glommed onto that. Some of the planetary correspondences to tend to link up that way, but that's not enough. However, the Western system, and that's Jacob Borm, Basil Valentine, Johann Gitchell, and this latest book that Stephen Flowers translated, Mr. Bodendorf's book on secret Turkish Freemasonry, and all of them. This is the straight line system, is the Western chakra system. So that lightning flash puts the sphere of Netzach right about in the solar plexus. That's right about where it is. And the sphere of the goddess, and it comes right on down through. Now, one thing I do want to point out, though, that the Western psychic center system is astral, not etheric. And we don't have nadis. We don't have the Idna and the Pingala, and we don't have nadis. And so, consequently, the relation of the paths to the spheres in the psychic center system is, I won't say it falls by the wayside, but it's sort of incorporated into the sphere. You don't have a complex knotting of spaghetti all over the place. They're more or less connected to the spheres as they are connected. Now, the sphere of Netzach, according to the way Basil describes it, and according to the way most everybody thinks about it, is that it is the sphere of Venus. And it is the sphere of, as I say, it's the sphere of the goddess. It's so for those of us who are really not trying to, to cling to biblical super morality and biblical oppressive biblical morality. This is a sphere that's holy for us. It's the sphere of, as I say, the goddess Astarte. It's the sphere, if we get cross, if we want to go with cross correspondences, it's the sphere of Green Tara. And in Tibetan Tantric Buddhism, the Tara cult conceives of Tara as the goddess, as the whole physical universe. She incorporates everything. This is a very, very nice way to look at it, and we would like to think about it that way. And so Netzach is also called Victory, as in the traditional Kabbalah. And the point here with this emperor thing is it's just totally out of sync with our enlightened concept of getting along and harmonizing with nature, rather than trying to beat nature into submission, rather than trying to conquer nature. I don't think that the term victory applied to Netzach, I think that's the victory of nature, not the victory over nature. And it's also, this is in the Golden Dawn, this is the sphere of the philosophers. You understand Netzach, you understand those forces, and you understand how to link up with them and how to balance them and how to get them to work with you and for you. Then you have mastered that particular sphere, and that particular sphere is the sphere, as I say, that is most apropos to the present neo-pagan movement and in all of its various manifestations. And not particularly the Gothic manifestation, but I mean the nature worshiping manifestation. And I like to think Netzach as sort of the key sphere of Feraferia. And speaking of that, I was hoping that Joe Carson would call in. And if you're out there, Joe, you might give us a call, because I want to get your thoughts on this. Seeing as how Netzach, I think, is the the sphere of it's a sphere of the goddess, and we should certainly have the thoughts of the avatrix of Farfaria and along with my male ramblings, and yet at least in this particular instance, I'm for the ladies in this one. I mean, I really got to get that emperor out of that path and let the forces of nature pour on into our collective unconscious and flood us with all this beautiful symbolism of natural love and beauty. And this, as Basil Wilby points out, this is the sphere of the Hieros Gamos. This is the sphere of the goddess and the god coming together and fertilizing. And of course, if it's astral, that means it's in a magical sense. So we can think of this as the forces of nature that we are going to master and understand. And one of the very important aspects of this is to master the sphere of the four elementals. And you can say also that Netzach this theory is a speculation here, because the elementals are obviously in Malkuth. That's where they are, and Malkuth is a very magical sphere, as we know. But there is an essence. There is a controlling. What is the word I want? A logos. Let's say an elemental logos. That's interesting. An elemental logos that sort of comes down from Netzach, and that green ray comes down and kind of inspires the elementals. We could say this is, so the realm of nature needs to be balanced between the four elements, the four cardinal signs, the four forces, which, by the way, as I'm sure all of us have realized by this point, is the essence of Hermetic practice, is dealing with these four elements. We continue all the way through, I mean, all the way up the tree and all the way through our development, we continue working with these elements and balancing these elements. And we balance them in ourselves and in our lives. And so one of the mythological aspects of this that here again Basil points out is being trapped in the Netzach sphere. I think Tannhauser was trapped in the Mount of Venus. Oh, we have a call. Who am I speaking with?
Hi, this is Joe.
Oh, hi there, Lady Joe. Good to hear from you. And now I'm just about to the point where I want to let you just take over and give us your thoughts on what we've been talking about.
Are you finished with the thought you're in the middle of?
Well, I'm just about to talk about Tannhauser spending 7 years in under the hill, you know, in Venus, and Basil was, you know, your friend knew Basil, you remember, and Basil was talking about how bad that was. Well, I suppose, you know, going away for 7 years and being ensorcelled for 7 years is probably bad in some ways. I mean, plays hell with your income tax, but still, you know, that was what I was getting at. But otherwise, come on, now give us your thoughts.
Well, basically, I totally agree with you. I think that the Emperor is a really, it's not just a strange choice, it's the absolute wrong choice. The star figure is a really beautiful card, and it has great symbolism that relates really directly to both Yesod and Netzach. And there's a kind of an easy quality between how do you want to get from, basically what you're looking for on a path is a card that's going to help you get there. I think that, you know, it kind of turns it into a greased skid, you might say, that so that you get to really slide up there to that next sphere easily with the aid of that card and its symbolism. And the star is lovely for that. The water symbolism is perfect. It has been said that the water is somehow the mystical mate of the earth, and so to have the water pouring down towards the earth is absolutely perfect in that regard, because it takes it up to that higher sphere, the water does, the salt water. So the thing with the Hierophant is they were going in when that Hierophant is, like, as you say, symbolic of his era, of Crowley's era. Industry was on the rise, and the earth was, quote-unquote, being subdued. You know, railway tracks and airlines were being put in everywhere. And the earth was being divided up and, you might say, conquered by nature. I mean, nature was being conquered by humans, and or more specifically, men in this case. And so the Hierophant certainly did symbolize that, but it's not really the right direction.
Joe, wait. Are you mixing up the Hierophant with the Emperor here?
You know, I am mixing up the Hierophant with the Emperor.
Yeah, right. But it's an easy mix-up. But I just want to get it. You're talking about the Emperor, right?
I'm absolutely talking about the Emperor.
Right.
I don't know what got me off that. I think I was looking through some of my books, and the Emperor was back in the back, and I didn't see it, and I saw the Hierophant,
yeah.
And I started obsessing about
the Hierophant.
But you're right.
I do that all the time, you know. Because the symbolism between the two is very similar. Go ahead.
Oh, well, just that, you know, what we need here, I think, and the people are becoming more aware of it certainly now, is that we need to be able to get to that sphere of nature really easily. We don't want to be blocked by a completely inappropriate symbol, which is going to stop us from getting there and start sending us into mental abstractions. So, you know, I certainly vote for the star. I think that's the right card. I think it always has been. And, you know, I've got a copy of the Golden Dawn in my hand, you know, one of the volumes 1 and 2 of the Golden Dawn on page 123, a beautiful plate, and then they have the star symbolism. So I think that's the right one. And the only question I have for you when you're speaking about the lightning flash is, looking at the one that they have here in this Golden Dawn book, it appears to go across from Netzach to Hod, and from there to Yesod. So I was curious, maybe you have a different version of the lightning flash that goes directly from Netzach to Yesod.
It goes, hang on a second. You're right, it does. You got me now on that one. You're right. It comes on across from, why did Basil say that? He was talking about the lightning flash going through this one. You're right, because it's got to go from 7 to, it has to go from 7 to 8 and then to 9 and then down.
Right.
So you're right. So I was wrong. I was thinking 6 and 7.
Well,
seven,
I was
six.
Just picturing how the lightning flash, the way it's drawn, it comes up from the top left. And if it was actually starting from the top right, everything would be exactly reversed. And then it would, in fact, go from Netzach to Yesod. And I was thinking maybe you had a version that did that.
I wish I did, but I don't. That's my mistake. So, no, it does. But even though I'm, you know, it's a mistake, it's still, in a sense, the idea is that the way the tree's laid out, these paths permeate down, and then they go back up. In other words, one feeds into the other, and vice versa. So this in this case, the Emperor is still, the Emperor's a plug. It just plugs that conduit, that very, very beautiful conduit, from the sphere of nature into the sphere of the collective unconscious.
Right.
So I'm right.
Well,
you're,
we don't
right,
need though. That. That's, I agree with you. Spot on.
we got our Kabbalist right here trying to do it, you know, and do it from while we're talking. But we'll get it straightened out. Anyway, to continue though on this, I can't figure. Let's mention, while we're mentioning this, a couple of other changes that were made from Levy's arrangement. You know, he changed, the change that was really, really obvious, and we can't figure out why Levy didn't see it, was justice and strength. Because justice obviously has to be Libra, and strength obviously has to be Leo. And he had it the other way around, and Westcott and Mathers, they saw that, and they straightened it out. But the other one, the other change that that they made that was really significant was putting the Fool at the top of the tree instead of at the bottom. And this really, what they meant by that was a concept called the Arch Fool and the Pure Fool. And the Arch Fool at the bottom thinks he knows everything but doesn't know anything about the afterlife or about immortality. And the Pure Fool at the top doesn't know anything, but he knows he's immortal. So those were the changes that were made. I think they were significant. To get back to Netzach, though, tell us about how you think this relates to Farfaria.
Well, in the sense, Farfaria doesn't use the Tree of Life too much as a tool, but just looking at what those spheres symbolize, certainly Farfaria stands really strongly in the sphere of nature, and we can say that the moon and relating to the moon is a way to become attuned to nature, and certainly in a really physical sense, anybody that goes out on a dark night when the moon's going to come up late and then sees a sliver of moon come up over the hill, there's going to be a strong response to that, and you can say it's an emotional response or a spiritual response. It really doesn't matter what you call it. It's a really strong response, and it's a response of something that's beautiful, but it also has a deeper significance. Everybody has a resonance with the moon, and women know that it relates to our cycle. I think that humans in general have always, just because we've always lived with the moon, especially before we had electricity, depending on it if we needed to be out at night. And so you can say that there is this human, really basic human connection between the moon and nature. And if you want to get to a feeling of oneness with nature, the moon is certainly a good way to get there.
Yeah. And, of course, that naturally would apply to your sun, and then we're on up to Venus. And Venus has a reputation of being the light bringer, and that brings us to this concept of Lucifer, which confuses a lot of people. I know both Albert Pike and Blavatsky both got their fingers burned on that one, because Lucifer means the light bringer, and that is equated with Venus. And so there is this angel Lucifer is really not Satan, although in many ways it's sort of been in popular mythology and all, it's almost become synonymous. Now, so every time I see a reference to Lucifer, I wonder whether the person who is using the reference actually knows what Lucifer really means, whether, and, you know, the light bringer. And Venus, apparently, the planet Venus, which, as you probably know, goes around the zodiac every 8 years and describes a perfect pentagram. The concept of Lucifer is actually Venusian. It's Venusian, but Venus, apparently Venus was a great deal brighter in earlier times. And I don't know why that is exactly, but maybe it's because we have too much smog and too much haze in the air these days. But Venus was a remarkable in olden times. Venus was considered one of the three great lights in the heavens, and so whether Venus has gotten dim or whether our atmosphere or whatever, I don't know. But I thought I'd mention that Venus is, you know, of course, is the planet of the goddess, on the planet of the planet of that relates to nature, and you want to give me some thoughts on Venus.
Well, she was certainly referred to as the Queen of Heaven because she had this perfect, as you point out, pentagram as her symbol, because she actually made that shape. And she was absolutely reliable, and you could predict timings of things by watching her coming up sometimes at certain times with the sun and at other times becoming visible directly after the setting sun. Being so close to the sun, if the sun is coming up, you're going to see her nearby. Likewise, when the sun is setting, from our point of view, she's always much closer to the sun. And she was just considered the most reliable of all the stars and the lights in the heavens, as you say. So that gave her that title or role of the ruler of the heavens. And it expanded out from there. And it's what I think would be interesting to discuss a little bit. Why is Venus so specifically considered as a planet, right? The association of love and Eros with Venus. That's something I would like. Maybe you could expound on that a little bit.
I don't really know why that is, except that it was Venus rising in the morning, and it is a morning star. It's referred to as a morning star, and it was very, very, very bright. And I think that as it was one of the three great lights, it seemed to be, I think Ishtar was as far as we know the first Venusian, goddess, and she was a tremendously powerful goddess, and that was the first one, and I think that the relationship to Ishtar is probably it. I don't think Venus is necessarily green to the naked eye. Mars is red. We know that. But,
right.
But I don't think, Venus is not necessarily green, but it seems that we all seem to think of it in this coppery and green symbolism. So I think it has to do with the morning and the light. I think that the morning, that's what
I mean, when the sun goes down too and has just set, we can see Venus. So she's the evening star as well as the morning star. Another thought on that, and I would be interested, maybe another caller would like to call in and talk a little bit about this, because it's an interesting point, but it's just the beauty thing when you have a little sliver, of a moon, there's like this thing that can happen with the sun and the moon coming up opposite of each other, and if the sun is setting and then the moon is rising, it can come up, and then maybe it hasn't quite come up and you can see Venus, and then it just exactly becomes occluded by the moon because it's full, and then at a different time it'll be the moon comes up as a sliver and you could see Venus very distinctly right next to it. It's an interesting set of relationships. I mean, because we have in Farfaria the moon is the throne of the young male god, and the moon is the throne of the Kori, the young goddess, and the sun is the throne of the young male god. And so we have those two figures. And then in Farfaria, there's not specifically a role for Venus per se as being, within that kind of family of divinities. So I'd be interested in hearing other people's comments on that, and I'm thinking that maybe I could sign off and let somebody else call in.
Well, go ahead, but I think we're just about to the end of the hour anyway, and we're only signed up for an hour tonight, so I think it's probably a pretty good time to wrap it up. And so thanks so much for calling in. Next week we're going to have, hopefully next week we're going to have a real, real big gun on the issues we've been talking about, and so hopefully we'll be able to have a guest who will really be able to give us some insights on the psychological, the deep psychological and spiritual aspects of this. And until then, tune in next week. And until then, good magic.